Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, July 7th, 2011. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, the second quarter wrap-up, we're going to take a look at what's been happening in the second quarter, particularly through the framework of where we're going with re-engineering of the currency systems globally, and it's just a chance to look back and get our perspective and then some quick comments on where we're going to go in the third quarter. Money and markets, I'll start with, and then some great questions and ask Catherine. Review and commentary on John Carpenter's sort of camp cult favorite, They Live, a 1988 film, sort of an oldie but goodie, really a weirdie. Our theme tonight is the view from the outfield, and I want to talk a little bit on one hand about what's happened to the Strauss Kahn, the former head of the IMF, and then talk a little bit about my trip to LA and then bring them down into why it's good to be sitting in the outfield right now. I got an email from a subscriber earlier this week. He said, "Hi, Catherine, I'm sure you've seen this already," and then sends me a link to the New York Times article about Strauss Kahn has released his case teeters. "I just wanted to say that I'm continually in awe of your ability to predict the future, a great quality in someone who gives investment advice. When you were skeptical about this case on the Soleri Report a while ago, I was having a hard time being skeptical along with you, but you were right, of course. Have a great fourth, a Soleri Report subscriber." Well, I had talked on the Soleri Report and with my colleagues about the fact that this was clearly a frame-up. I mean, you suddenly throw the head of the IMF in prison. He has to resign. That makes this deputy, a J.P. Morgan guy, in charge of the IMF while you're trying to jam Greece. You jam Greece, then you put in a very charming, attractive French lawyer who just happens to be the former chairman of one of the biggest Chicago firms, Baker and McKinsey, and then voila, the day later, the guy who has been thrown in jail in New York for a sex charge. Oh, it turns out that the evidence wasn't credible. Well, what a surprise. Anyway, it's funny because many aspects of that frame reminded me of the one that they tried to run on me. And what was shocking to me is I forget, of course, that other people, you know, don't look at the news like this. And it's hard for them to fathom that the New York District Attorney would just arbitrarily do this on orders from on high, which it doesn't surprise me in the least. If you look at the money that, you know, sort of power and money that was on stake on getting Strauss Kahn out and getting the Greek deal done in a way that would satisfy the Americans, it doesn't seem surprising at all. And it's given that Strauss Kahn was running for presidency in France, kind of wonder what the backdoor deals were between France and Germany and the United States behind this one. But it was quite a perfect example. For those of you who don't know the October surprise story, it's not unlike the October surprise story where the Reagan campaign made a deal on the hostages in the Middle East, and then literally Reagan is sworn in, and within the next hour the hostages are released. And, you know, and you kind of wonder why they want to make it so obvious, but it's the obviousness of it is a clear signal that, sort of who's the boss. But very, very stunning. And we are now left at the IMF with the financial equivalent of Obama, including, you know, somebody very charming, sort of a Ninja Turtle kind of type, if you know my story about the Ninja Turtle. She's Christine Lagarde is a vegetarian, practices yoga. Very, very personable, very easy to like, very competent, very intelligent, very hardworking. So we kind of have a new Obama at the IMF, and it's going to be very interesting to watch because she's the perfect charming front for the next round of centralization, which is probably going to be particularly ugly as it is in Greece. And so it's a very good front, just like Obama is a very good front for what's happening coming out of the United States. I went to Los Angeles last week. I had an amazing trip. I went down to do Coast to Coast on Thursday night for an hour live in their studios. But first I had the opportunity to have to meet and have dinner with a couple of clients who I've worked with for a long time by phone, but never got to meet, and they were such extraordinary people. It was such an amazing evening and conversation. And then I drove after Coast to Coast down to San Diego and got an opportunity to get revived, sort of like a day at the spa, at the Southern California Institute of Nutrition, which is Dr. Laura Thompson's institute. Many of you have heard her on the Soleri Report. And then John Rappaport and I did a conversation that we filmed. Hopefully John will get it up on the internet. But it was basically about the divine intelligence and how the divine intelligence always stays ahead of the sort of the pro-centralization team and the horrible games that of the kind that are going on in Greece. And so we talked a lot about appreciating the miracle of you know, the grace in the universe that's always at work despite what the Midianites are doing. And so it really was sort of the view from the outfield. And it was nice because change is accelerating. It's nice to sit in the outfields. It's nice not to be in the machinery that Strauss Kahn was in. So I'm one of the things I'm perpetually grateful for is that I can now work for individuals and families rather than working for large corporations and governments, because playing in that machinery right now is no fun. And I must admit that I'm having a lot more fun than I used to. And for that, I owe a debt of gratitude to every one of you because you make it possible. So enjoy the view from the outfields. It's a good place to be right now. Money and markets. Three stories this week I want to talk about. The first and most important is what we're seeing with the debt budget deal. And I say debt budget deal because there are two things in tandem. One is we're coming up on the debt limit, which is a technicality, but it's something that has to get the approval of both Senate and Congress and the White House, and it has important fiscal ramifications. And of course, while you're struggling with that debt deal, you're also struggling with what the budget is going to look like that has to be passed by September and will go into effect for the 2012 fiscal year beginning October 1st, 2011, this fall. So we've seen lots of talk and going around about the debt and budget deal, and now a trial balloon from the Washington Post announcing that Obama's put Social Security and Medicare on the table in exchange for getting an agreement from the Republicans to go along with tax revenues. Now, who knows what this could look like? The reason I bring it up and underscore it is the headliner is I am concerned that if they're going to tinker, that the first time they tinker in any kind of meaningful way with Social Security, then 401ks and IRAs are going to be part of that deal. That's the logical way to get that passed. I was assuming that that's probably a 2012 at the earliest deal. If they're going to talk about it in connection with the debt limit, 401ks and IRAs could be back in play on the table. And so I just want to notify you of that. I'm going to be watching very carefully. But there's no doubt if that gets put on the table, then we could be in a position this year of having to say, you may want to rethink how much you've got in your 401ks and IRAs. You know, so nothing to talk about tonight, but it means it's back on the watch list. I continue to believe that the debt deal, the real debt and budget deal, will be finalized at the Bohemian Grove at the end of July. So I'm looking to the third and fourth week of July for important signals and, of course, the legislation. The debt deal has to be passed and resolved, I would think, before Congress leaves on August 5th, or Treasury has to pull some rabbits out of the hat, which I'm sure they can do, particularly with the help of the Federal Reserve, which I'm sure they'll get. But whether they legislate a portion by August 5th before they go on recess, or they legislate it for the budget in September before the October 1 date, what we're going to watch between the third week of July and October 1st is a whole lot of new deals come down. My expectation is you're going to see two things. One, you're going to see a consensus on a QE3 that will translate, believe it or not, into a strong dollar, using the debt and budget deal as the harbinger of fiscal responsibility. To do that, I think what they're going to do is they're going to make deep cuts in Main Street entitlements, including messing possibly with Medicare and Social Security. It's going to have all parts of the financial establishment grousing, and it could easily have Main Street in real shock. So I think to get a QE3 with a strong dollar, they're gonna really sock it to Main Street. So let's see what happens. We'll know a lot more by the end of the month. I want to just comment a little bit about the law on the debt ceiling. We've seen a lot of concern about, we have to be in compliance because it's the law. I want to underscore that the federal government has disobeyed the laws on financial management for decades in a very serious way. So the idea that we have to comply with the law is a bunch of hooey. We haven't been doing it as a matter of practice for quite some time, including refusing to comply with the laws related to having an audited financial statement and the fact that over $4 trillion that we know of is missing from the federal government. Now, this law is one that relates to process between the Congress and the administration, so it's a real constitutional issue, and it's always been respected. But there have been plenty of games behind the scenes to keep things going when they couldn't, when they couldn't get an agreement on a debt ceiling. So do I think the United States government is going to default? Only if the top guys want it to, it'll be a matter of policy. When you can print paper, you don't need to default. Second story, Greece. The disaster capitalism party grows. The U.S. and the pro-centralization team got their way with the Morgan guy temporarily in charge at the IMF. We jammed this through the Greek legislature. I'm sure there was more than a few dirty tricks to get that done. If you want to understand what's happening in Greece now, all you have to do is read. I put up a news story on the blog this week called Pumping Goldman, and I describe some of the sort of things, big money moves in the 90s that Goldman was a part of, including the rape of Russia and some of the IMF deals in Latin America. Sort of the asset stripping that occurred on privatization in the 90s. And if you read those links, if you read Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism, you'll get a sense for what's going down. We got a great question from one subscriber this week. He said, well, don't you think the top guys are kind of destroying the economy in America, but really stopping socialism with Greece? Well, no, actually, if you look at the numbers and you look at the extraordinary extent to which any county economy is dependent on government programs, government subsidies, government credit. I would say that the U.S. economy is much more socialized than the Greek economy. If you look, again, and this was up on the blog, if you look at the numbers of hours worked in the U.S., it's 1,700 on average every year. In Greece, it's 2,100. Greeks are working much harder than we are. And if you look at our extraordinary dependent on government debt, I would say socialism, you know, the Soviet Union had nothing on us, is all I can say. And so, I think what's happening in Greece is happening here at a slower pace. Let's see if it accelerates or not. They have a reason to want to go fast in Greece and stay slow here. The goal is not to... What can I say? Again and again, I'm just going to keep saying it. The debt system is not a financial system. It's a governance system. It's a control system. And their goal, they don't care about productivity. This is not about maximizing the total equity of total wealth or total health of the economy. It's about maximizing central control and maximizing the equity on the corporations as they shift the assets out of sovereign governments and into corporations. And the goal of that is not to make money. The goal of that is to re-engineer how risk is managed and assets are managed on planet Earth. But the large multinationals are going to have a food fest, and that is almost like feeding the hungry tapeworms. You know, it's almost subsidy into the tapeworm to keep the game going. Again, part of the challenge of doing this is the more you feed corporations with this kind of profits, the less productive they become, because you're not running things on a market economy. It's a politically managed economy. The third story is the mortgage fraud story grows. The housing market continues to soften. The latest numbers are not so wonderful. Particularly frightening is the St. Louis Fed said that the QEs have cost the U.S. dollar 6 to 0.5 to 11% in value. So let's just use the number 10%. If the housing, and this is grossly oversimplified, if the housing market was up 10%, all you've done is keep even with inflation. The fact that it's down means that in real dollars or in gold dollars, it's down more than 10% by a lot. So, you know, this is a painful thing, and we're continuing to see more and more come out on what happened and how it happened. Part of it is the continual bad press that Goldman is getting. If you read the Puffin Goldman piece, I go through the little circle of Goldman Sachs first helping to move the jobs abroad to Asia, then helping to bubble the housing market, understanding full well that they had just finished engineering the income out of the economy abroad, so how in the world was anybody going to pay down this debt? And then engineering a big short on the housing market and bringing down the very paper that they then sold to the buyers. So basically, you know, slamming the mortgage ores and the mortgagees, you know, simultaneously in one decade. And so sort of shooting both sides of the market from the middle. It's a very ugly picture, particularly as more and more people get a hold of it. We saw the Bank of America agree to an $8.5 billion settlement with the New York Fed and BlackRock and some of the other buyers of Countrywide paper. This is after B of A bought Countrywide and bought the liability. Now, the idea that the New York Fed and BlackRock are the harmed parties in this is kind of, it's like a bunch of pirates suing each other over a hot potato that they've been passing around. So you'd love to know the deeper story there. I'm sure there is one. Marie McDonald did a incredible report for Southern Essex in Massachusetts on the extent of mortgage fraud, an audit on the mortgage situation. It's up on the blog. And it's a perfect example of how bad the problem is. Now, given that the Fed has basically financed the banks out of more than 100% of the value of total residential mortgages in the country, you know, they're covered. So where this goes, you know, it can go many ways, but it shows you sort of the extent of what's got to be cleaned up. It also shows you the extent to which the federal government and the big banks have gotten financial power through defaulted mortgages in places. And of course, given that the administration is now revving up both rural and urban redevelopment programs, you know, it puts them in the catbird seat to sort of re-engineer communities as they like. Our Solari hero of the week is Abigail Doolittle, who has a website and company, Peak Theories, and gives very interesting market commentary, which always keeps me thinking. My partner, Chuck Gibson, subscribes to her commentary, and she put out one this week called Why QE3 is Inevitable, which was quite good, but she coined a new term that I want to point out to you. It's QE perpetual, and she writes, let me just read it. She says, however, the very nature of such asset inflation is temporary. She's talking about the asset inflation that comes from QE2. Or transitory, and particularly in the context of a deflating housing market and a velocity of money that is near a 30-year low. Such factors strongly point to a stagnant, swamp-like economy that is a breeding ground for prices and even wages to drop as the months tick on. In turn, so long as deflation is of any concern at all, QE3 or even QE perpetual is on the table. This is a woman who understands the inner essence of engineering the slow burn, which is the sort of balancing of monetary inflation with labor and asset value deflation, which has been going on for quite, you know, as globalization has occurred. This is at the very heart of sort of engineering the political economy. Okay, that's it for Money and Markets. Ask Catherine. I got a great question. I'm going to read this one, but I've gotten this question about three or four times in different variations, and it has to do with the possibility of a more deflationary scenario as opposed to a lot of the inflation scenarios which are being talked about in the financial blogosphere today. Let me just read it to you. While I agree with your long-term view of gold and silver, and I understand the danger of owning wealth in fiat currencies that can and are manipulated, I do believe that we are going to see a major dollar rally soon, and this may hurt gold and silver. European debt problems are only going to get worse the longer the can is kicked down the road. There is also a massive Chinese bubble that I believe is about to burst soon. The whole debt ceiling issue is just political theater and must be resolved, of course, by destroying middle-class social programs. And of course you will agree that the U.S. military has all the tools it needs to force the U.S. dollar down the throats of the world. I know much time is given to precious metals in the Slayer report, and I agree and understand with most arguments made on owning gold and silver. I have been buying all decade and have agreed with everything that is said here. I'm not selling any of my physical gold and silver, but I am not a buyer at this time. Unless the Fed surprises with QE3, I'm not betting against the tapeworm for now. The dollar will not collapse when everybody expects it to, and gold won't go to 2,000 when everybody expects it to. Just curious what you think. I think these are very reasonable thoughts. I think the chances are much more likely for a dollar rally in the next couple months than a dollar collapse. I do think we're coming into a situation where you could see both a dollar rally and precious metals up scenario as well. But for years, as everybody says, silver or gold is going to the moon, I disagree. I think this is a much more managed process. I do feel even if the deflationary scenario with a strong dollar happens, it's important to understand that if you look at where we're going in terms of moving towards a global currency, we can easily see a strong dollar and strong precious metals at the same time. So I wouldn't assume that those are necessarily going to trade against each other. But I think it makes sense to be prepared for a dollar rally. And I would also say if we get a dollar rally, it's an incredible time to shift into the emerging markets, because 1% to 2% on a U.S. Treasury versus 4% to 10% on a strong emerging market equity, I mean, that's a no-brainer. So if we do get a strong dollar rally, the long-term trends of a stronger emerging markets are going to be with us. So I would see that as an opportunity to shift smartly. Next question on the web. The WebBot project is predicted a dollar collapse in October. I don't see it. I don't think it's likely. There's no reason. It goes back to all my discussion of the slow burn, but I just don't see a dollar collapse. I think we always have to be prepared. So we could have strong dollar or weak dollar. It could go either way, and we just have to be prepared to manage through a long-term global rebalancing. Next question, capital gains on stocks versus tangibles. I've gotten several questions this week as to whether a capital loss on a stock can be offset against taxes on the gains on a tangible, such as gold and silver bullion or gold and silver at gold money. The answer is yes, if both were for investment purposes. So if you're a dealer with gold and silver in inventory, the answer could be no, but assuming it's for investment purposes, the answer is yes. Even those are taxed at different rates, they can offset. We had gotten many months ago a great question on ZKB. We've prepared a special report, ended up talking to lots of brokers. It's a very interesting story. We will post that on the blog sometime by next week and talk about it next week on the Solari report. Another great question. A lot of great questions this week. Can you suggest a good thesis topic for a senior college student majoring in economics, business, and real estate that might help him get a job after graduation rather than foreclosing all such job opportunities for being unpolitically correct? Here's a topic suggestion, and my discussion in the wrap-up will explain more about why I think it's so sizzling. The latest developments in financial transactions, clearing, and settlement systems, and the implications for the strategic plans of leading technology providers and banks, including the cyber warfare implications. Let me just say that again. A thesis on the latest developments in financial transaction clearing and settlement systems and the implications for the strategic plans of leading technology providers, banks, including the cyber warfare implications. And I have to tell you, if your son does a thesis with that title and does a good faith effort of rounding up the latest writing on these topics, so even has that sort of bibliography, I have to tell you, I think it would do a fantastic job of getting them in an interview anywhere they want to get an interview, whether it's in the technology industry or the financial industry. But if that is not of interest to the particular student, let me know and I'll come up with a I'll come up with a second alternative. Another great question on mortgage fraud, which I want to do some research and answer next week. So keep the questions coming, and I'll keep trying to answer them. Okay, second quarter wrap-up. When I did the year-end wrap-up, we did it in January, so we did a transcript that is up at the control panel, and it's next to the section in January on the year-end wrap-up. And it has an overview of key trends, and there's really, you know, all I can say is if you want to know the key trends, they didn't change in the second quarter. If you didn't get a chance to look at that transcript, I recommend it to you strongly. What I wanted to do with the second quarter wrap-up is change is accelerating, and there have been so many, you know, literally shocking things that have happened at dazzling speeds. And on one hand, they may look very chaotic and, you know, all sorts of happening over here in this sector versus this industry in this sector. But if you step back and you look at it from a very, you know, let's go sit up on the moon and sort of look down at Earth and look at them from that kind of big picture perspective, they all make sense within the framework of looking at this push for global governance and particularly a global currency system. And so I want to just step back and talk about the move and shift to a globalized or more centralized managed currency system and view all of these things in that context, because I think they start to make a lot more sense and things stop looking as Orwellian as they sometimes can look. There really are two. I walk back and forth between two worlds a lot of times in my life, and one is the world of the official story, and everybody keeps trying to explain why things are going wrong because things are not working in the official story. So, for example, you'll hear constantly all the people who are angry about the war on drugs and talking about why the war on drugs isn't working, and we have to change the war on drugs because it isn't working. And, you know, this is a conversation that just keeps going on and on and on. It's very cranky. And, in fact, when the war on drugs is, if you look at it and you say, okay, well, how's the war on drugs working in terms of optimizing profits and management of both the legal and illegal drug businesses and engineering central control and financing the black budget, it's working beautifully. I mean, it's working fantastically. But that's because it's working fantastically if you look at the war on drugs from a second point of view, which is not the official story, but what I call Mr. Global's point of view. And for those of you who haven't heard me talk about Mr. Global, Mr. Global is kind of a metaphor. He's a mythic character or a metaphor for basically the leadership of the pro-centralization team. But it's kind of just a simple way of looking at the planet from the point of view of the guy who's responsible to run the governance systems and evolve the government systems and who, you know, takes it upon him or herself to make sure everything is working as it's supposed to work. And what Mr. Global is trying to do is to centralize the system. And Mr. Global is managing all sorts of technology, including new technology and technology we don't even know about. And they're trying, you know, Mr. Global is trying to run a global government with assets that are increasingly controlled and managed by corporations and not through sovereign governments. And one of the things that Mr. Global clearly wants is a centralized currency system, because when you're trying to run complex operations in a world where currencies, you've got lots of different currencies and lots of different currency rules and complex financial transactions like derivatives to hedge in different currencies, it's just nowhere near as necessarily convenient, although Mr. Global can certainly make a lot of money on the complexity and sort of front-running the whole thing. But the two systems, whether it's a governance system or a currency system, very much go hand in hand. And you need to re-engineer national sovereignty if you're going to bring up the centralized legal and financial systems. You need to support a centralized financial currency system. So they're like two sides of the same coin. And what we've been watching is a real push by Mr. Global to kind of get this done and get this accelerated. So we've been watching sovereign governments literally be engineered in, or fraudulent inducement of sovereign governments, and Greece is just the latest example using the debt system. And then we've also been watching building an infrastructure that will help implement digital currencies and ultimately a global currency, and the ultimate will be a global digital currency. So I just want to talk about, I want to go through sort of the different aspects of this, because I'm hoping that it will help you as you walk around in the third quarter sort of see the patterns. I'm a big believer in pattern recognition. Anyway, first I want to tell a story. And that is, in the early 90s, after I left the Bush administration, I ended up one night at Imelda Marcus's house. She was renting a brownstone from Doris, or I guess using Doris Duke's brownstone in the 60s in New York. And so I ended up at her house one night with having dinner with Max Warburg, who had just been put in charge of the Warburg interests in Hamburg, Germany. And yes, it's Max of Warburg, of the Warburg family that you've all read about in the Engineering of the Federal Reserve. And we were having a discussion about the fact that Chancellor Kohl in Germany had literally tendered for the East German currency by setting a very attractive exchange rate with a West German currency. And it was at a time after the Berlin Wall had come down, and there were many pundits who right before then had been talking, oh, you know, unifying East Germany and West Germany is going to take decades, and it's going to be a very complicated political process, and who knows what's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And Kohl just fixed the whole thing by literally tendering for the East German currency. And it was funny because I sat down at dinner and Max was saying, oh, you know, Kohl, he did such a stupid thing and such a terrible thing. And I said to him, Max, you know, he just tendered for the East German currency and unified the country in 24 hours when pundits said it was going to take 10 years through a political process. Seems kind of brilliant to me. And Max just cracked up laughing. He said, well, I didn't think you'd realize what had just happened. And I said, no, it's pretty obvious, but it's a perfect example of, or it was a perfect example of engineering, jump-starting a political process and cutting out 10 years of conversation with one financial move that literally has one country taking over another. It's a great story as a backdrop to what we're watching, because literally what we're seeing in Greece, what we've been seeing around the world, is whether you're using reengineering the debt system or reengineering the currency or both, what you're basically seeing is a financial invasion, financial coup d'etat, financial invasion. Rather than landing our army, you know, we send in the banks, get them, you know, fraudulently induce the country, get them, you know, sort of over the, get them over the barrel, and then force the legislature to basically let us do what invaders do, which is, you know, strip the place of all the assets. And so, bottom line, the currency is at the heart of it. Now, let's talk about a couple important trends that you can see in the various stories that we've been watching in the second quarter. Currency, you want to look at the technology stories, because building out the wireless infrastructure, whether it's smart meters, cell towers, wireless systems, cell phones, handheld apps, all of these things are infrastructure you need for both digital surveillance and digital currencies. And the pressure to get the build out, whether it's stories of forcing cell towers on communities, forcing smart meters, there is a top-down command that is demanding that this infrastructure go in. No one is allowed to be an exception, and it's quite a squabble place to place, you know, where they're getting pushback on it. But one of the reasons is you cannot do digital technologies and other sort of digital issues, including digital currencies, unless everybody's got it and everybody knows how to use it. So the push to get this stuff is integrated. If you look at the president's new Rural Development Council and executive order, again, focus on getting internet access into the rural areas and cutting down on post offices, because remember, post offices provide the money order system, which is still a major currency to people who don't trust banks and don't trust the currency system and electronics. And so sort of getting them out of money order and getting them onto a digital system is imperative. You can't do that without certain speeds. And so the build out into the last marginal places is being pushed. Great New York Times story that's up on the blog this week. The title is "As Plastic Rains, the Treasury Slows Its Printing Presses," and then what they talk about is the Treasury, which has been spending a lot of time over the last 15 years trying to do that, is printing a lot less paper and getting a lot more people on digital systems of various kinds. We've seen in connection with this big post up on the blog from something written by a reader and a subscriber. I called it "The Green Scam Cometh," because a lot of what they're going to use to get people on these various systems is promote them in the name of green. So smart meters are green, and getting things wireless are green, and there's going to be all sorts of green justifications used to kind of get people centralized into a digital system that can be promote central control. Another big, so one whole wave of stories is coming from the technology angle because they're trying to build out the infrastructure. The second angle is to look at the payment policies. I talked earlier in the Solaria report about J.P. Morgan charging customers just usurious amounts of money who want coins, for their shop instead of taking credit cards and PayPal and other digital systems. More pressure across the board, of course, to use credit cards, PayPals, to make sure people have credit cards. I can't tell you how many people I've heard in the last year tell me, oh, if I don't have a credit card, I can't fly. Getting welfare and food stamps on debit cards, very, very important. So there's a whole nother series of stories related to this, related to payment policies that are kind of getting people digitized. We see a lot of stories about iPhone apps that can get people using, getting comfortable using their cell phone or their iPad or, some kind of handheld instrument to do digital financial transactions. So trying to figure out how everybody just hits a button and sort of accesses their bank account and pays for things through iPhone apps and things that they can do on a cell phone. Okay, so technology, payment policies are two whole sets of stories. Another very important set of stories, and you've heard me talk a lot about this, so I'm going to keep talking about it, is farmland and food policies. We've seen tremendous acceleration of centralized ownership and control of the agricultural system over the last 3 months and 6 months. It's really breakneck speed. After the E. coli outbreak in Europe, which I said I thought was biowarfare, sure enough, we're now seeing lots of sort of talk from the Europeans. Yes, they're willing to go along with irradiation. Well, we know irradiation has nothing to do, I believe, with stopping E. coli, but I think the threat is either you go along with what we want or you're not. You're going to have more biowarfare outbreaks. I was on Coast to Coast last Thursday night, and the guy speaking before me was talking about why it was so important for food safety to pasteurize your eggs. It's a bunch of hogwash. All it does is destroy the nutritional value of the eggs, but that's another part of the line. We have just rumor after rumor, which I suspect is probably true, of the farmland flooding in the middle of America, resulting in the Army Corps of Engineer and other people coming around and buying, offering to buy up and aggregate farmland. If you're interested in sort of the farmland dirty trick story and sort of centralization of farmland in the U.S., there's a great book called Harvest of Rage by Joel Dyer about the policies used to literally wipe the small farmers off the land in the 80s. It's a fascinating and very well investigated piece of work, and it shows you how a combination of the central banking and federal government policies have been engineered to literally just wipe out small farmers. So the idea of the Army Corps of Engineer and a variety of government agencies doing the same to farmers this time around would be no surprise. Now, why am I saying all this has something to do with currency? If you look at the world from Mr. Global's standpoint, the biggest challenge that Mr. Global has to manage at any given time is the line on what technology is allowed to come out of the closet. So the line of what technology is integrated in our day-to-day lives and what is available is a political line. It's not an economic line. And a lot of it has to do with the challenge of governing and managing economies and any governance system with powerful technology. So, for example, what if a new wonderful technology could radically increase the fertility rate or radically expand life expectancy? So let's say technology exists so we all live to be 200. Well, what's going to be the implication to the population and environmental balance? What's going to be the implication to whether Mr. Global can continue to feel confident he's going to control? You know, so new technology can present very, very big problems. What if the new technology dropped the cost of energy by 50 to 90%? Well, if you look at UFOs, and there is tremendous evidence that UFOs are very real, they're clearly not driving around on, you know, on Exxon. They're clearly not operating on a fossil fuel model. We know that the Nazis had basic UFO technology in the 1940s, and it was one of the things we most wanted when we won the war is to get those scientists and bring them back here at the end of the war. So, you know, whatever is flying out of Area 51, I suspect, you know, much of it is being flown by humans, and they're clearly not filling up at the Exxon station. So the reality is we know that there's energy technology available that is not in the, you know, in popular use. Well, the reality is that we've managed to control the currency and the reserve currency globally because we've tied it and to fossil fuels and controlling fossil fuels. And, you know, whether it's the smart meter that lines up to your back door or it's the naval control of the sea lanes and our use of those kinds of systems to control energy, that has been essential for setting the value of the reserve currency. And if we're going to change the energy technology, then the chief question is going to be, what's the asset that's going to continue to maintain control in the economy and make sure that your currency is the reserve currency, whatever it is, whether it's the dollar or something else. And so the more I watch the incredible effort to control agriculture, the more I suspect that part of this is because food and water are the logical replacement. And that's why the patenting of life and GMOs are such a hot issue, and why I think their implementation is being carried out with such incredible force and dirty tricks. So there's a real financial imperative to replace oil control with the control of alternative assets. And to me, and do it in a way that doesn't bring about a population explosion. And I think a lot of what we're watching may be explained by that possibility. Just as a side note, I want to just underscore one of the wild cards I most worry about when I work as an investment advisor is a shift in any of these technological boundaries, because they can have a wild impact. It takes a long time to implement new energy technology. So let's say tomorrow somebody stands up and says, I have a cold fusion toaster, and every house in the world can run their energy, you know, for 10 cents on the dollar of what they're spending now with this cold fusion toaster. Well, it's going to take a long time for that technology to get integrated. But what it can do is it can melt the multiple on the stocks of everybody who's in the old model. So as an investment manager, if you get a real game-changing technology, it can have a very dramatic impact on stock market values, even though it's not something that can be realized in the near term whatsoever. So one of the things I constantly watch is this line on technology. And what's happening with food really does make me wonder if there's a game changer coming up in the next, say, 3 to 5 years. Another thing that has been happening that makes me ask this question is I think that arguably the most important event in the second quarter was the events at Fukushima. And the events at Fukushima, which continue, followed up by what's happening with nuclear reactors in connection with the U.S. floods here, including in North Dakota, and the impact that they've had on nuclear policies around the world. If you had told most people 2 years ago that we would literally see countries around the world, including Germany, saying, you know, that they were going to phase out all nuclear power within a certain period of time, that's quite amazing. Now, since I give 75% chance or better that Fukushima and the Gulf oil spill were the result of covert operations, not just natural events or accidents, then someone's playing the oil card, but they also may be teeing up an energy switch. So, you know, these are things I continue to watch and worry about, not because they are something that could happen soon, but because their impact could be so dramatic, including to sort of to the kind of game we're talking about here about getting to a centralized currency. Anyway, so what the energy policies and what the food policies are going to be very important to this move to centralized currency. But either way, the centralization of agriculture is underway, and many of the stories we watched in the second quarter underscored that, and it's going to continue. Be prepared to watch that in the third and fourth quarter. Again, I wanted to stress that the debt system is a governance system. It's not a financial system. I was really disturbed in the second quarter about how many of my clients and subscribers got really afraid about the collapse theories, including the fact that if Greece defaults, then the euro is going to fall apart, and the European system is going to fall apart, and we're going to get a complete collapse of the financial system, which is now being replaced by the sort of, oh, in October the dollar is going to collapse, we're going to get a complete collapse of the global system. Mr. Global uses the financial system as a governance system, and there's no reason that because he doesn't get his way in Iceland or Greece or a particular country that he would then concede and give up on his system. You know, if you get a complete collapse, then he loses, you know, the system that he uses to invade and control. Why would he do that? It doesn't make sense. Now, that's not to say that he wouldn't selectively collapse, as we talked about before. You know, you collapse Russia and make money on it. You collapse Eastern Germany, make money, and you take the IMF into Argentina. You collapse Argentina, you make money on it. Yes, that's been happening. It's part of, you know, money exiting in one currency high. You collapse the other country, and then you go in and buy all their equity low. That's exactly what's happening in Greece. So everybody will have a very profitable picking up of cheap equity in Greece, and then a year or two or three from now, we'll get the message in the newsletters and in the financial community, oh, Greece is coming back. And retail investors will be invited to come in and buy into all the positions that will lift up those equity positions that those guys bought for cheap. So it's kind of the pump and dump and pump of a country. But the collapse theories that assume that this is a financial system, and therefore if one sovereign government collapses, we'll have the financial system collapse, I think are naive. Now, what is not naive is that what we're talking about politically is a very complex process to manage. And so what can happen is what happened in 2008, which is, you know, the pro-centralization team gets to warring with each other, and we get a real meltdown. And that absolutely can happen because it's a big planet and people fight, and what's happening is emergent. It's, you know, Mr. Global's control. He is influencing and governing a very organic system. And there's, you know, it's just like imagine just a second, a big corporation like Exxon. Everybody, you know, has turf wars and vice presidents fight, and things can get out of hand. So, you know, can a 2008 or worse happen again? Absolutely. As I said before in the year-end wrap-up, my sort of scenarios, I've gotten a couple questions on my scenarios for 2011, my scenarios for planning and portfolio strategy are 65% chance slow burn, which is what we've been doing. Our watchword for this year is slow burn on the prairie, and that's what we've been doing, slow burning. 2008 redux is about a 25 to 30% chance it can happen. The best time for it to happen, or the most likely time for it to happen, would not be this summer, but in October. October is sort of the silly season. And then collapse 5%. I think the chances are very small, but I think it pays to sort of prepare, be prepared and have a plan for that scenario, because it is an outlier, but it, in theory it could happen if a 2008 spiral turns ugly and things get out of hand. Now, I would note, for those of us on the pro-decentralization team, 2008 and collapse are probably better for us long-term. The slow burn is our most dangerous scenario. Most people think slow burn is better for them. I would argue not. Coming up, we have a debt deal to be finalized. I think the debt deal and the budget deal are most likely finalized at the Bohemian Grove starting in the third week of July. It's one of the reasons I think we're going to get some very important signals coming out of the Grove, so I'm looking to the third and fourth week of July for important signals. Again, I think the budget deal is going to be quite shocking for Mainstream Street. It's going to be unpleasant for the line military, which has now been stretched by Mr. Global around the globe. QE3 is going to continue to finance the slow burn. With the right fiscal deal in Main Street, we could get a QE3 and a perpetual QE that would be strong for the dollar. So I don't anticipate the collapse of the dollar. I do think a QE3 is going to help finance a new development plans. We're going to see both big urban and rural development plans rolled out through the U.S. government. The Democrats will use it as sort of their push for what they're doing for jobs in the new economy and coming into the election. But they'll also be looking to do big global development, so it won't just be in North America. A big part of this is going to be unbelievably invasive technology marketed as green. So it's going to be, green is going to get to look very ugly. I'm reminded when I was working on the financial permaculture conference, I was talking to a young permaculturalist in Tennessee who clearly didn't understand the extent to which green was going to be used as a scam. And I looked at her and said, you need to understand that many right-wing fears are far from hogwash. So anyway, so bottom line for the second quarter, what we're seeing is Mr. Global is frustrated. He's getting ready to accelerate the push for centralized currency and control. That's what Greece says. That's what all this push to get the infrastructure built for doing things financially in a digital form is all about. The currency has as much chance of evolving from a strong dollar as a weak dollar. It can go either way. There are a variety of different ways to do it, but basically Mr. Global likes a managed process with occasional collapses in selected places or occasional 2008s and everywhere, but not a collapse everywhere at the same time. That's not good for Mr. Global. The important variable is not whether the dollar is going to be strong or weak. That's not what this is about. It's about whether or not a centrally controlled digital currency system, whether it has one currency or multiple currencies, can be engineered. So as long as it's digital and so long as it's centrally controlled, Mr. Global couldn't care less whether it's dollar, peso, gold, silver, or wampum beads. What he wants is it's digital and it's centrally controlled. So keep that in mind as the various different factions that push for different scenarios or different vehicles, just remember we could end up with a gold and silver system, which is simply just as ugly as the dollar system has been, or even worse. So the push is on. He's frustrated. He's going to push hard for the next two quarters. So I would say get ready, because change is going to accelerate during the third and fourth quarter. Okay, that's it for the second quarter wrap-up. Let's go to the movies for a second. I chose arguably one of the weirdest movies I've ever watched, called They Live, as the one I wanted to talk with you about today. And the reason I wanted to talk to you about They Live is because the biggest threat to our personal health and wealth is living and working with people who are not in alignment with us, don't have our best interests at heart, and really have a predatory approach to us. It's one of the reasons I try and get everyone to get out of banks which are run with policies that are not in your best interest and mine, and get you into banks with people who really are in alignment with your best interests. So they make money from your success as opposed to money from your failure. And you know, part of the challenge with dealing in a world where warfare is defined by economic warfare and financial warfare, it's really helpful to understand who sees you as prey and who sees you as a fellow human. And They Live is a sort of a camp cult favorite. It's a science fiction horror film. It's directed by a guy named John Carpenter. He made it in 1988. And it's clearly a very low-budget film. And in the film, the ruling class is a moneyed elite, and they are, in fact, aliens. And they manage human affairs they use a lot of entrainment and subliminal programming through a TV broadcast, which conceals their appearance. They look like humans, but once the signal goes away, they look like aliens. But the humans can't tell who's human and who's alien. And it's really a metaphor in a funny kind of way for what a more down-to-earth book described, which I've talked about before, and you can find the review on the blog. It's called Political Ponerology. And it talks about, it's written by a Polish scientist who, having lived through Hitler and Stalin, he and his colleagues got together and sort of figured out that 5% of the population is really psychopathic in nature, and another 20% is willing to help that 5%. The 5% is very good at organizing and sort of engineering things to their benefit, and the other sort of 75% of the population can't fathom that people are willing to behave in such a psychopathic manner. But once they understand that, they have a way of sort of dealing with it effectively. Now, in the movie They Live, what happens is a group of humans figure out how to make sunglasses. And if you put the sunglasses on, you can see sort of who's an alien and who's not. Well, what we all sort of need is we need to be able to put on sunglasses and see who is in alignment with our interests and who's not. So who's acting, you know, sort of in the predatory psychopathic manner, and who's not, who's kind of a human. And I've seen my whole life people try and sort of build those sunglasses. So, you know, Republicans are good and Democrats are bad, or people who work at nonprofits are good and people who work at big corporations are bad. And, you know, so there are all these systems of trying to sort out who's a good guy and bad guy, none of which have worked because, in fact, it's kind of a very invisible thing. And yes, different corporations or organizations or groups tend to have different interests, but I think what we're all searching for is a way to kind of put on the sunglasses. And in the movie, you see some funny things. So you see one guy who does everything he can not to put on the sunglasses because he feels he can cope much better if he doesn't see what's really going on. We've all dealt with that phenomena because it can be sort of overwhelming to kind of look behind, you know, the great Oz. We also see the role of TV. I keep talking about turn off your TV, turn off your TV. Part of that is because of the amount of time it takes, but the other is because of the entrainment technology and subliminal programming. Finally, we see a guy, and one of the most interesting scenes in the movie is a guy who thinks it's great to go along because if you play ball, they'll give you a ton of money, you'll have what you want, and, you know, why not go along? Who cares? And it reminds me exactly of a scene and different scenes I experienced when this crazy thing started in the mid-90s. The World Trade Organization was approved. They started moving tons of money out of the country, bubbling the economy, and it was like the world had gone mad. And I'll never forget sitting with Dick Ravitch, who was a former client of mine, who then became, just finished a couple years as lieutenant governor of New York, and used to be a very dear friend and literally now is, you know, someone I wouldn't speak to. I was sitting with Dick at the Jockey Club in Washington in 1997, and he looked at me and says, look, as long as I can get government subsidies, what do I care if people have education or jobs? I mean, it was literally like somebody you thought you knew had become a complete stranger, someone who literally thought, you know, what was going on, which was essentially genocide, was, you know, who cared? He was making money. And I saw this again and again and again with people that I used to know and work with. I could give you many, many stories, and will, I'm sure, over the next year or two on the Solari report. We're working on a special report now on Sallie Mae. It's one of my former board members who was right in the thick of engineering what is arguably the worst form of predatory practices and policies I have ever seen in a lifetime. I can believe now that he did it, but, you know, if you had told me when I invited Bill Diefendorfer to be on my board that he would ever do such a thing, I couldn't fathom it. Now I can. So we're literally seeing people go mad, and understanding who's a good guy and who's a bad guy is important. I had a wonderful conversation with a wonderful client who helps me with important research for the Solari Report, and we were talking about how in disasters most people are good. So it's very, very important to not lose our faith in the human race. There's example after example of despite these policies and the evilness of some of them, the response of so many people that are good. But we need those sunglasses. And one of my goals in the Solari Report is to help you build your sunglasses so you can discern who's aligned with your interest and whose interests are alien to you. So if you're ready for a really weird cinematic experience, watch They Live. And I think you'll get some stories out of it which are helpful to you in navigating what is a very human world, but a world filled with people who, for whatever reason, have decided to adopt a predatory approach. Okay, well, that's it for this week in closing. I wanted to give you a heads up. I'm sending out a very important press release next week announcing the launch of my new company, Sealian Advisory. It's a 50-50 partnership between my company, Solari Advisors, and a wonderful investment advisory firm in the San Francisco Bay Area, Financial Perspectives, that's run by my partner, Chuck Gibson. I've been working out of the Sealian offices in Pleasanton, California for several months, and I'm having a wonderful time, and I love to build family wealth. It's what I do, and I much prefer doing it when I'm part of a team. I feel like I'm much more excellent to be with very strong people and very strong partners. So heads up, that press release is coming next week. I wanted you to hear it from me personally rather than just get the press release, but a very important event in my life. Next week, I'm very much looking forward to, on the Solari Report, Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders. When I'm away from Tennessee, I get really homesick to talk with Franklin. We have lots of stuff to talk about in the precious metals market. A lot of people waiting to see if the correction is over, waiting to see if they should buy this month. Among other things, the Silver Pump team is appearing to rev up for Act Two now that they've rested from the profits they made running up the silver to 50 and the dump down to the low 30s. So that's one of the things I want to talk about. The top 10 transcript that we've been doing on the 10 most important dates in the history of precious metals in North America will be up and out before next week. So take a look at that. That's beautiful. Then we're going to have, after precious metals, the following week, Scott Tipps, arguably the top guy in the world fighting Codex and head of the largest health freedom group, and here to talk about what Codex is, what it could mean to us, what to expect over the next couple of years. And then the following week, or the first week in August, Sally Fallon, head of the Weston Price, an amazing, amazing group to talk about food policies. And again, because I believe that's at the heart of both your health and the new currency system, you're going to hear me keep coming back to food because I think it's very important. Thanks for your questions and suggestions. Keep them coming next week. Get those precious metals questions in, because I know you've got a lot of great questions on precious metals, and I've been saving the ones over the last couple weeks, and we'll batch them for Franklin. Again, the ZKB question will be answered. We'll have that article out next week and be talking with you about it next week. So please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.